This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه ومن استنى بسنته إلى يوم الدين. All praise due to Allah and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. In the month following Operation Desert Storm, the Saudi Arabian Cultural Information Tent was set up in the middle of the main processing camp for U.S. soldiers at Khobar Towers in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. The tent provided cultural information about Saudi Arabia in the form of books and videotapes, as well as Islamic literature for free distribution and sale. A series of small discussion groups with American military personnel were held during the days, and a large open discussion group was held every evening from sunset until midnight. Many Saudi military personnel and civilians, as well as American civilians and some U.S. military Muslims, shared in the discussion and in the dissemination of information. By the time that the American troops were completely processed out of the country, over 3,000 American male and female, black and white military personnel had accepted Islam. The following tape was made during one of the evening discussions in May of 91. Abdus Salam Muhammad, the Latin from Manhattan, was the host, and I, Bilal Phillips, was the guest speaker. The questions were asked by American military personnel who took part in the Desert Shield, Desert Storm operation.
The virgin birth of Jesus Christ could be just as much of a mystery. Thank you.
Well, before you go on, I would just like to say that when we talk about mysteries and, you know, what God can do from an Islamic point of view, we look at things whereby God and His divinity is maintained, and man, as a creation of God, is also maintained. We do not believe that God becomes man, nor that man becomes God, nor that God has a son, which is the way of man, that the attributes of God are unique to Himself. He does not share these attributes with His creation. So when we read in the New Testament of Jesus being the Son of God, we look at it in the same context in which Adam is referred to as the Son of God, David is referred to as the only begotten Son of God, and these references to Son of God are throughout the Old Testament, indicating a closeness to God as opposed to being an actual physical product of. So we maintain a monotheism which is unique in that God is God and man is man, totally distinct. In the way of creation, we cannot understand how God creates, because that is a function of God. Creation. How God says be, anything is when nothing was. When we create things, we create it from things which existed. We make a car from iron which was melted from, you know, rocks, and, you know, things existed before. When we make life, and people like to say we made life in a test tube, we're actually producing life from life. We don't take dead matter and then produce life. We're not able really and truly to create. That is something unique to God, which is beyond our comprehension. Because when you really understand a thing in its essence, then you are able to manipulate that thing. You become greater than that thing. When we understand how a tree functions, how it grows, the principles that are involved, we are now able to manipulate the tree, make it grow in directions that we wish, you know, to change the type of fruit that it produces and all these types of things. When we have understood that thing, whereas in the case of God, there is no understanding the essence of God and how He creates. So, mystery we accept in that sense, that God created Adam from nothing. How he did it, God alone knows. God created Eve from Adam without a mother, God alone knows. God created Jesus from Mary without a father, how? God alone knows. This is his way. He creates us, human beings, from a father and a mother, and how that actually takes place, the essence of it, we don't know.
That kind of special, though, the fact that God intervened at the point of Jesus.
Well, we don't look at the question Brother raised was it not special in the case of Jesus how God intervened in the process of his creation? We are saying that it is no more special in the case of Jesus than it was in the case of Eve, or than it was in the case of Adam, because Adam created from neither father nor mother, and much greater, if we were to put, you know, levels of greatness, than creating from merely a mother. Because even biologically, today the scientists say, we can biologically understand how a virgin may give birth. You know, you have women who are not married, who have never had sex, who can go to a sperm bank, get some sperm, and give birth without ever being married or having sexual relations. I mean, this comes within the realm of understanding. But how a man may come into existence without either a father or a mother, that is even on a greater level. So, we don't look at the creation of Jesus, in the sense of him being born without a father, as being beyond human.
Did God have need of a human woman?
Did God just all of a sudden have need of a human woman in the flesh? Or, you know, there's got to be a reason why.
Well, we believe that there's a reason. His birth was miraculous, as miracles were given to the prophets before, to show that they were indeed prophets of God. We believe in something about Jesus which Christians don't even believe, don't know about. It was mentioned in the Quran that Jesus, when he was born of Mary, and she came back to the people, because we don't, in the Quran, there's no mention of Joseph. She came back to the people, and they were astounded that she gave birth to a child, when she was supposed to be a pious woman, and she was unmarried. They questioned, how could it be? How could you do such a gross and evil thing? And she pointed to the child, and God revealed to her that if she questioned, she should point to the child. And when she pointed to the child, Jesus spoke as a newborn baby. This is something which is not even mentioned in the Gospels, something which we as Muslims are required to believe. This is one of the miracles which was given to Jesus, that he spoke in the cradle as a newborn babe.
I read that in the Quran, and I thought that was interesting. It's not in the Bible, but I wouldn't expect it to be too unmiraculous either, if the virgin birth, you know.
Yeah, sure. It's not beyond it, I mean. But I'm just saying that not only do we accept the virgin birth, but we accept that. Even in the Quran, we also accept that one of the miracles of Jesus was that he would gather clay, mold it in the shape of a bird, blow on it, and it would fly away, a bird.
Well, I don't probably have a choice to doubt that. He didn't anything.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, he accepts that. But at the same time, when it says that in the Quran, it says that Jesus said that this is by the will of God.
Yes.
Making clear to the people that this was not him. He was not doing this, but that God was doing it.
Yeah. He made it clear that he was in one accord with the Father's will.
And we believe that this was the case of all of the prophets.
But wouldn't that make him the greatest of all?
No, we believe that all of the prophets were in accordance with the will of God.
But he's the only one that had no sin. That's what so many believe. He's the only one that even claims that.
Well, the point is, for us, we believe that Jesus did not die on the earth, you know, as was
fleshly death, but not a spiritual death.
We did not believe in a flesh or spiritual death. That he was in fact raised up by God, and then he would come back to the earth as one of the signs of the last day. He would live out his life on earth, marry, have children, rule on earth as a leader of those who submit their will to God.
When? At what point in time?
I would say one of the signs of the last day. In the future, we have not, there's no date set, but it's one of the things which are prophesied by the Prophet Muhammad and also prophesied in the Quran.
Who is Jesus now?
No. We believe that Jesus was raised up by God to a station we are not able to define where, how, etc., etc., but that he is living and will come back down to earth and continue his life and die on earth.
It's so close to it. I've read, and but if you believe all that, I don't understand why that we can't believe in the resurrection and his purpose in coming. I don't understand. It's so, I don't know.
You see, I think the fundamental difference is that you believe in the need for a sacrifice.
It was preached all through the Old Testament.
This is an interpretation of sacrifice. We believe in sacrifice in Islam. We as Muslims, are obliged to or encouraged to make a sacrifice on a particular day of festival, in celebration of Abraham's sacrifice or willingness to sacrifice his son. But we don't believe that this is indicative of the need for a divine sacrifice, to cleanse man of his sin. That this sacrifice was in fact, and the sacrifice which is enjoined on people, is symbolic of their willingness to sacrifice what God has given them, recognizing that it is from God for the pleasure of God. Because when we sacrifice the animal is not thrown away, but that the animal is the body of the animal is given to the poor. We've been given the ability to have an animal, to buy that animal, to have it, and we show our willingness to sacrifice of the wealth which God has given us for the sake of the needy, whose situation is due to the destiny of God, and we recognize that we have a duty to them. This is what we believe of the significance of sacrifice.
I guess in the Old Testament, it talks about maybe not the actual meat of the animal, but the blood of the animal being spattered on the altar as a sense of the cleansing for the sin, or the wrong, or the error.
The Lord's
divine sacrifice.
Well, I think, though, that the point you're raising in terms of the splattering of the blood, this is a question of interpretation as to whether it was in part actually cleansing.
As his final sacrifice to man. We're talking about the Old Testament.
Lord, that isn't the Old Testament. It doesn't include. The Lord became tired. The sacrifice of animals became a stench to the Lord's nose. It had no meaning no more.
So in our context, we don't believe in the Lord becoming tired. This is a human quality.
Jesus is on earth. He's all around. You see the poor. You see the hungry. You see the homeless. And you see those in need. That is Jesus.
Jesus in our name.
You're helping Jesus. Remember that. He was the final sacrifice. Through him is the only way you can get to heaven.
Okay, well, let's see. Wait. Now, the only way to get through this sentence is checkpoints out of here. All right, let's see. Now, we are not here to preach, nor are we here to be preached to. All right, that's good. One down. Next. All right, question, answer. I'm just trying to have one of these reoccurrences here of a monologue. We really do monologue. Our brother Bilal was doing this, I guess it was a one-on-one, whatever, but we normally do dialogue, okay? We dialogue with each other. We don't monologue, okay? But my man, he wants to pull out or whatever. Let's try to get a different perspective.
Brother
was on. Yeah, what's up? He got a for like, I don't know why. He's talking to me. Name right to me, Lisa. Pennsylvania?
Where
is this? I don't know. I have a question about religious leaders, they talk about the Vatican, where the Pope stays, and you have Mecca, which is your home of the Islam, and but the leaders, different religious leaders, are not there, but they're elsewhere.
Well, there are no religious leaders per se. The only religious leader who we recognize as being infallible in that sense, right? Because when we talk about the Pope, we talk about somebody who is recognized in Catholicism as infallible, right? The only person we recognize as being infallible in the sense of religion teachings is the Prophet. And the Prophet, the last of the Prophet being Muhammad, may Allah peace and blessings be upon him. So he is the only religious leader in that sense who we are obliged to follow. And as such, we don't have any other people who hold a status which may be equal to him, where we might want to put them in our what is considered to be the sanctuary of Islam, say Mecca.
Just wondered, people like the Shiite Muslims, the Ayatollah, what would his proper job then be, or his proper title? He's not a religious leader,
well,
per se.
You see, the Ayatollahs, you know, what is known as Shiaism, now you're getting into sort of, you know, details of sectarianism, right? The Shiite religion, per se, is considered a deviation from mainstream Islam. You know, just as, for example, mainstream Christianity, if we could call that the Catholicism, this was the earliest church, it looked at Protestantism as being a deviation from mainstream Christianity. And Protestantism looked at people like the Jehovah's Witness and the Mormons as deviation from mainstream Christianity. Similarly, mainstream Islam, you know, 80% of the Muslim world, look at Shiaism as being a deviation from mainstream Islam. It proposes concepts about God which are alien to the basic teachings of Islam as it has been handed down written in the Quran, in the traditions of the Prophet, etc. And so, naturally, once they've deviated in terms of the actual theology, how they look at God and man, it's not surprising then that you can find amongst them a priest class, wherein the Ayatollah now becomes somebody similar to the Pope. Whereas in mainstream Islam, Orthodox Islam, if you want to call it that, there is no such title.
What does the Ayatollah mean, actually?
Ayatollah literally means a sign of God.
Arabic, what language?
Arabic,
yes.
Arabic.
Okay. Yeah. Next, you did development? Questions, observations, or comments? Here we go. So I just wanted to say one more thing. You know, you seem real well educated, but it's like you talked of the Prophet Lot earlier, okay? You said that he committed the ultimate sin.
No. We don't believe that he did.
Okay, but he committed one of the most, you know, one of the worst ones.
We believe that that's what's recorded in the Bible. We don't accept it. We don't believe that he did.
Okay.
We reject it. We look at that as being something written by human beings, which has been interpolated into the messages which were brought by the Prophet.
Okay. Well, the way I believe, okay, I believe that that did happen. But when you talk of the adultery that happened, you know, not the adultery, but the incest that happened then, okay, it was not all on his part, though. You know, it doesn't say anywhere in the Bible that, you know, getting drunk is one of the worst sins. Okay, like me, myself, okay, I've got, you know, drunk before, and I'm sure there's a lot of people where they don't remember what they did. But if you read in the Bible, it talks about how his daughter set him up for that. So that was not of his will. That was a mistake, as you speak of mistake. Now that's like a question, can God build a rock so big that he can't lift it? You know, I mean, come on, he wouldn't use his intelligence like that, you know?
Well, the point with this is that when you say that he was not responsible, you're saying then that a person who is drunk, who commits a crime, no matter how heinous it may be, he is not responsible. But according to Mosaic law, according to Islamic law, drunkenness is not looked at as an excuse. If you commit a crime, if you murder somebody in a state of drunkenness, if you rape somebody in a state of drunkenness, then you are held to account for that crime, because you're not unconscious. You are still conscious. You still have a will. You know, your inhibitions may be broken down, because this is what alcohol tends to do. It breaks down your inhibitions, so you may be willing to do things in a state of intoxication that if you weren't intoxicated, you may be shy from doing. But you still have a will. You still can decide. This is why in America, if you are caught in an accident for drunken driving, the whole weight of the law is coming down on you. Because they tell you, if you get drunk, don't drive. You have the will, you have the ability to decide not to drive. So therefore, when a person is in a state of drunkenness and he commits a heinous crime, he is still responsible. He still has his will. So this is why we don't accept it. Because according to the writing of that segment of the Old Testament, it implies that Lot, though in a state of drunkenness, he willingly indulged in intercourse with his daughter. And we don't accept that that would be an action of the prophet, based on the teachings of the Quran. If you want to accept it, you know, this is not something really, you know, it's worth really, you know, arguing in at length about. It's a question of your, how you conceive of the prophet. I mentioned the Islamic picture, and, you know, you mentioned the Christian interpretation. If that's what you feel fine with, you feel comfortable with it, that prophets would commit such crimes, well, you know, that's with you. I just explained to you this, as we said, this is like a dialogue here, you know. We can exchange thoughts and ideas. Not necessarily that I'm saying that, you know, you must accept my idea. No, I'm just presenting to you what is the Islamic view, you know. If you don't want it, well, you know, you don't accept it, that's your choice, you know. Up to you.
Okay. Questions, comments, observations, chutzpahs, and sermons. We do it all.
Kathy Yeller again with 411. I have a question that hopefully you might separate the Islam religion from the politics of Saudi Arabia, possibly. A little bit I've read of the Quran and understand of the religion, it seems that priests and other religious heads could have come into this country and worn their insignias and given services without any worry about negative impact from the government. But I knew when we came over here, many of the priests did take their crosses off and wear their rank because they said it was not a good idea to wear it around and things like this. Was that more of a political problem versus an Islam problem, that maybe they thought some people might react to it? Or is that something in the Islam religion that I just haven't gotten to, that
I think
they can't pray in?
No, I think this is more a question of people being worried about offending other people's sensibilities. You know, between the American military and the Saudi military, American military made certain suggestions to avoid, you know, problems and so on. So even they told soldiers who were coming here, don't go near a mosque. You know, don't talk to certain people, you know, to avoid certain sensibilities. But Islam doesn't say you can't go near a mosque. Islam makes it perfectly allowable for you to walk inside of a mosque. Look, if you want to see what's inside of a mosque, you can go ahead and check it out, you know. It's more in that order.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Yeah, if I may, Captain, I myself personally have escorted at least maybe 30 guys, 30 soldiers in their BDUs, combat boots and all, on several different occasions during the holy month of which just passed, Ramadan, to observe Muslims, not only myself, but Saudi Muslims and other nationalities in a mosque setting, in the observance or practice of their prayers during the special month of the special prayers at the mosque of the fifth and final prayer of the day, the evening prayer. They partook in meals, this guy and the other, and it was fantastic. It was gorgeous. I mean, they slipped out of their skulls. I mean, they slipped out of the green socks. I mean, you know, I mean, green like in dollars, but these green socks, you guys are interested. And the combat boots, I mean, they freaked out. Because they said, this is contrary, man, to what with the orientation that we received back home. We thought that once we would arrive there, that Saudis or the Arabs or the Muslims, actually the first one was Muslim, you know, these guys got long fangs, you know, sticking from their mouths, and, you know, I mean, the saliva just comes off, and, you know, it wasn't like that at all. They shot. Okay, in fact, quite a few of them became Muslims at a later time before they got on the management. Questions, comments, observations, from the guys? No? Okay. Told him not to counterfeit Iraqi money. Yeah. Questions, Sergeant? Hey, guys, Adam? Adam, sir. One Adam, sir. One Adam. There you go. Name right to the week,
huh? Oh, I'm from ABC.
You're from Hawaii, right? You see the guy who's 5-0 with such Adam.
No, I'm from Ohio.
Ohio? Okay. Dayton, what question should you submit to our distinguished brother Bilal Abu Amin Phillips from Jamaica, West Indies, via Canada, via United States, via Riyadh currently? Okay, a brother who has a lot to say. Please, what question observation can you take? If you don't have any, we'll pull out
the other. Well, I've noticed when we just came from downtown, we were walking around the area, and some of the women wore veils, and some of them wore like a half veil. I mean, some wore where their eyes were left open, exposed, and then some it's like a total black covering. I was wondering, you know, why the variation of veils and no veil, and are some of them Muslim and others aren't, or
no? They're all Muslims. The requirement for the woman, the basic requirement, is the covering of everything except for her face and hands. And she's also recommended, you know, to cover more if she wishes, right? So you will find women taking whatever level they prefer. But the basic, like the bottom line, if you want to say it, is, you know, everything except for faces and hands. And, you know, in fact, this is something which, when you look back in the case of Christianity and Judaism, when you see any paintings that they make of Jesus and the women who were around him, you know, Mary Magdalene and the other, whenever they make these paintings, you find them wearing these veils and covered up everything except for their face and hair. So in fact, you see, this is the continuity of Islam. And Islam is not something which is modified, you know, with each generation, where you find, for example, the nuns of, you know, earlier times, they used to wear a full habit, you know, they were all covered up. They look just like the Muslims of today. But now, as time went on and the dresses got shorter, you know, in the society, their habits got shorter. Till now, they're wearing, you know, short skirts and a little thing on their head, and they're looking like everybody else. The religion has modified itself, changed with the changing of time. You know, and that's really not the religion of God. The religion of God is something which is stable. If it was right then, it's right now. Good and evil are not things which are relative. This is really, you know, a basic part of the teaching, what we believe to be the teaching of God. But good and evil are not things which change from time to place, etc., etc. No. The evils of alcohol exist back then, and it exists now. To rape is a sin back then, and it is now. Homosexuality, prohibited by the Bible, was wrong and sinful then, and it is now. Islam doesn't modify it and say, well, okay, since there's a lot of homosexuals around today, and they're all clamoring for their rights, now we're going to make, you know, we'll reinterpret the teachings, you know, because we have to give some consideration to them. No, these are sick people, we believe, according to Islamic teachings, they're sick people who should be helped.
Brother Bilal, well, being on the topic of homosexuality, lesbianism, maybe it's one of our least liked topics, but it's a common occurrence and trend. It's a growing trend in America and other countries throughout the world. What is Islam's position on homosexuality, lesbianism, and how is it cured, or if it is, or how is it dealt with, or how is it placed in check, how is it seen economically according to the Quran? Is there a penal, stipulation on that?